from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
More than 100,000 people took part in a memorial service for Charlie Kirk this last week, even as Charlie's wife, Erica, publicly forgave her husband's killer. This week on Register Radio, we talk to Archbishop Joseph Naumann on the power of forgiveness. And then, Pope Leo XIV gave his first lengthy interview since his election as Pope. We're joined by Register Senior Editor Jonathan Liedl with analysis. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, host of Register Radio and EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director. I'm here, as always, in our Washington, D.C. studio with Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. Shannon, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Well, the memorial for Charlie Kirk in Phoenix, Arizona was attended, as I noted, by more than 100,000 people and watched by millions around the world. One of the key themes of the memorial was forgiveness. Charlie Kirk's widow, Erica, forgave her husband's killer, saying, quote, "I forgive him. I forgive him because it was what Christ did and it's what Charlie would do." We're privileged to be joined by Archbishop Joseph Naumann, Archbishop Emeritus of Kansas City. He recently wrote a powerful commentary for the Register under the title of My Father Was Murdered Too. I Pray Charlie Kirk's Family Finds the Grace I Found. It's how God uses tragedy, even evil, for good, one of the great mysteries of our faith. But that is what we believe. Your Excellency, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be with you and with your listeners.
Well, your piece really hit on the power of forgiveness, of grace, of the problem of evil. But let's start, if we could, with your immediate take on the memorial service for Charlie Kirk.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a powerful service. I don't know that there's ever been anything quite like it in American history. And it was beautiful. I think it empowered politicians to speak about their faith in a way that they just don't. You know, it was more than God bless America, but how their faith moves them and touches them, especially at a tragic moment like this. And that's what I think so many admired about Charlie Kirk, is about how upfront he was, about how his faith motivated him, and that was his deepest desire, was to lead others to Christ and to the truth. So it was an extraordinary moment, and I think it could really be a turning point in our country where politicians are not, we're not, we don't want to be a theocracy, but we need to talk about those principles and where they came from that really are the foundation for our country. And that involves faith in a loving God, in a merciful God.
Your Excellency, there were many descriptions of the memorial service really as more of a revival event as much as it was a funeral for Charlie Kirk. So many themes. The big one, though, is forgiveness. Erica Kirk's comments, which were so moving, forgiving her husband's assassin. How did that impact you?
I mean, it was inspiring. It brought me to tears for her courage in saying that in a public forum like that. But obviously, she, like her husband, was a deep woman of faith, and she, as she articulated, she did it because it's what Jesus himself would do. It was what her late husband would have done, and yeah, I think it was extraordinary, and it evoked in me memories of my own background. And my father, he wasn't assassinated as Charlie Kirk, but he was murdered. And I'm so grateful my mother, when he did this, I was in utero, so I was in some ways unaffected. But I'm so grateful my mother, she never focused on the person who killed my father. I didn't even know his name until much later in life, where it came up in a conversation, but but that she didn't, my brother and I, it wasn't a focus on the evil, but on how God was still present with us. She taught us never to feel sorry for ourselves, that we were blessed, and that God could bring good even out of this evil. And as I said, my mother became a school teacher and a principal, and she affected thousands of young people's lives with her faith, and that maybe would not have happened if it weren't for the tragic killing of my father. And so I think I see that coming out of this terrible tragedy, Charlie Kirk's death, that the Lord is bringing good out of it, in the sense of people returning to church, to their faith, and people being willing to really to be witnesses to the difference that friendship with Jesus Christ makes in their life, and the importance of faith.
Yeah, you have a beautiful commentary on your father, and especially your mother and her faith. There's a line that you use that how God uses tragedy, even evil, for good is the great mystery of our faith, but that is what we believe. And I know a lot of people right now are wrestling with that very question of how evil can happen, that evil is seemingly allowed. Can you address that? Because it keeps coming up in conversation, certainly in social media.
Yeah. You know, Jesus didn't promise his disciples that they would never have adversity or suffering. In fact, he said the opposite. If you're going to follow me, you have to be prepared to take up the cross. And so we shouldn't be shocked, in a sense, that if our Lord is one who was crucified himself on Calvary, that we're suffering is going to impact us. He didn't come and say he was going to remove all suffering, but he immersed himself into our human condition, even to suffering, even to death on the cross. But out of that, of course, came the resurrection and life and the triumph over evil and death. And so that mystery, I think, is present in our lives all the time, that we see things through the lens of the Paschal mystery, the dying and rising of Jesus. And so at moments like this, I think that's what our faith summons us to. Naturally, there's sadness, there's anger, but in the end, I think we have to turn it over to the Lord, who entered into our human condition and died for us, but gave us this promise of life. And what he did promise, and this is what my mother always stressed with us, is he didn't promise we'd never have suffering, but he would always be with us, and we would never be alone in the suffering, and that he could draw good out of it. And part of it, I mean, I don't know if I would have been a priest had that not happened, because part of the results of that the priest in our parish were extremely close to our family and were great friends and took an interest in my brother and I. So I see this now 70 years in retrospect. God did draw good out of this evil, but he redeems it. And so I think that's what, I think, Erica, that's what she was pointing people to, not to allow ourselves to be consumed by anger, but to turn to the Lord and be confident of his presence with us.
Your Excellency, just a quick observation. One of the things, because you've written about your father and the circumstances of his death before for the Register, but one of the observations that you made, you mentioned that, you know, you didn't know your dad, but you know about him through his relationships and through his choices that he made in his life. First and foremost, you note, is choosing a wonderful wife and mother of his son. So that was just so beautifully put, number one. But secondly, you also spoke about the power of prayer and the prayers of your father's friends and colleagues, the people who are close to your mother, how that really made a difference in your life. What's What specifically should we be praying as Catholics for in the wake of Charlie Kirk's assassination?
Obviously, we should be praying for Erica and for the children. You know, this is obviously a tremendous loss to them, and to pray that for them, but also that the Lord will surround them, which is, I think He is, with a community of faith that supports them in this. And I think it's beautiful that Erica is taking up the lead of her late husband's ministry and promising that it would continue. Some of your listeners might remember the name Molly Kelly. She was this amazing pro-life advocate who was so gifted in speaking to young people about the sanctity of life and also about chastity. She came, her own husband was killed in a sledding accident when she had 8 children. One was an infant. But he was a leader in the pro-life movement in Philadelphia, and so she chose to keep his memory by becoming this great advocate for life. And I see a parallel in what Erica is doing with Molly Kelly, who reached tens of thousands of young people with the message about authentic love and life. And I think Erica, you know, wants to continue this ministry that is drawing young adults to open their hearts to faith and to religion, which our culture, a lot of times, they might allow faith, but they criticize religion. And yet, that's where we find our strength in moments like this.
Yeah, Your Excellency, you write, I pray for Erica, her children, and for Charlie. I pray that the pain of this event will be a grace for this country so in need of healing. I pray for all those inspired by Charlie Kirk that they may continue his legacy of a desire to communicate the truth, witness to faith in Jesus Christ, cherish the beauty of marriage and family, and finally, a love for our country despite its current wounds. It's a very powerful statement from you, and I know all of us are grateful for this piece, for your generosity to the Register, and for your wisdom in this particular moment.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the great work the Register does. I read it every edition, and it provides a lot of nourishment and strength. So thanks.
Well, thank you, Your Excellency, and please, God bless. Well, you're listening to Register Radio on EWTN Radio. Next up, we talk with Jonathan Liedl, Register Senior Editor, to discuss Pope Leo's first major interview. Stay tuned to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. I'm Matthew Bunsen here in our Washington, D.C. studios with Shannon Mullen, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register. Well, Pope Leo XIV recently gave his first extensive interview since his election as Supreme Pontiff. The wide-ranging discussion with reporter Elise Allen of Crux covered a host of so-called hot-button issues, including the idea of women deacons, synodality, LGBT issues, and the traditional Latin Mass. Register Senior Editor Jonathan Liedl has written on the interview, and he joins us now. Welcome, Jonathan, once again.
Great to be with you both.
Well, you have an intriguing analysis that answers the question, why did Leo XIV avoid a Francis-style firestorm in his first sit-down interview? Before we jump to that, I'd love your take overall on the interview.
Yeah, my overall take on the interview, you're right, Matthew, that there were a whole bunch of different topics that came up, everything from sort of the Vatican's role in diplomatic relations in places like Ukraine, Gaza, but then also those hot button issues that are so divisive in the church. And I think kind of throughout the whole thing, what I saw Pope Leo doing was sort of say, hey, I'm not, you know, my job is to build bridges, right? I'm the Pope. So my job is not to kind of be the star of the show, but is to try to bring, you know, different people together, whether that's in terms of an international conflict or whether that's different groups within the church. So the image that came to mind for me We heard before the conclave back in May, we heard people like Bishop Robert Barron talking about the papacy, the role of the Pope, maybe as more of a referee, more of an umpire, right? Someone who's not sort of driving all the action, but is there kind of ensuring that, you know, that the rules are followed, that unity is maintained. And I think that was a takeaway for me, an overall impression, is that Leo really sees his job in a world that's deeply divided, in a church that's very polarized, sees his role primarily is bringing about unity and harmony. So that I think that came through in a lot of different ways.
So I think it should be said that 13 minutes is not going to do justice to this topic. I'm talking with someone who's written now two pieces, Jonathan, on the Crux interview, and the man who has written a best-selling biography of Pope Leo. So I don't think we're going to cover everything. But I did want to just quickly ask Matthew to kind of weigh in just on your own quick take on what you read in there.
Yeah, and in some ways, my reading through it, one thing that struck me is that I'm wondering if we're seeing in some ways a baseline now for how he's going to approach these interviews in the future. He gave a series of answers that looked at, frankly, both sides. To your point, Jonathan, about sort of being a referee or an umpire calling balls and strikes. I think he was clear on some issues. A few people have been desirous of more clarity on some of the other hot-button issues. I think in particular of synodality, that the question of potentially changing church teaching, which he described as unlikely. But I think also he answered very strongly some of the questions that people had about the issue of women deacons. And he went back to something that he himself said during the Synod on Synodality last year, you know, in 2024, the dangers of clericalizing women, and then also that it could create more problems than we could ever hope to solve. So I think we're starting to see not a go-to set of answers, but I think themes that he's likely to develop in the future.
Yeah, Jonathan, to your piece, you bring out a great point, which is certain phrasings that Leo used, had they been spoken by Pope Francis, they may have landed differently. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I think during this interview, those hot-button issues, we can kind of single out one, for instance. You know, he was asked a question about how he plans to sort of engage pastorally with people who identify as LGBTQ. That had been a major emphasis. Francis, what will Leo do? As part of his answer, you know, he had he said a lot of things about that, and we'll get into that. But there was one passage, right, that I think jumped out to a lot of people, and I can read it. He said, "I think we have to change attitudes before we can even think about changing what the church says about any given question." And he was saying this in the context of church teaching related to sexuality and marriage. He went on to say, "I find it highly unlikely, certainly in the near future, that the church's doctrine in terms of what the church teaches about sexuality, what the church teaches about marriage, will change." So what was really fascinating to me was that Leo said that, and there weren't a lot of people. You had some kind of sort of LGBTQ activist types like Father James Martin. You had some sort of very traditionalist types who jumped on that phrase and tried to say, oh, Pope Leo is, you know, being wildly ambiguous or being very open-ended, but most people didn't take it in that direction. Whereas if Francis had said something like, you know, the church, I find it highly unlikely, certainly in the near future, that the church's teaching on marriage is going to change, I think the narrative that would have quickly emerged is something like, you know, Francis is potentially open to so-called gay marriage, albeit not, you know, quote, in the near future. But we didn't see that reaction. It was really kind of interesting. And, you know, you and I, Shannon, talked about this last week. And I think a lot of it has to do with how basically from the get-go, Pope Leo has laid down this narrative of himself as a unifier, right? That's been a major theme in what he said. It's a major theme in what he's done. Those symbolic gestures, wearing the mozzetta when he came out on the porch of St. Peter's Basilica, you know, all kinds of outreach to traditionalists and things like that. Whereas Francis, in the early years even of his pontificate, you know, he made it clear that he was a reformer. He was there to shake some things up. He was there to change things. And so when you have that kind of underlying narrative, right, like one guy's a unifier, one guy's here to shake things up, how those words, right, about like, oh, I think changing church teaching on sexuality or marriage is unlikely, certainly in the near future, it sort of takes on a different meaning, I think, in those two different contexts. And I think that's why we saw, you know, Pope Leo say comments that were somewhat open-ended, and you're not sure exactly what he means, but we didn't see, you know, a kind of firestorm. And that both within the Catholic world, but also I think the mainstream secular media, who I think often wants to kind of, you know, pull the church in a certain direction, they couldn't really, you know, make a lot of hay out of that either, right? They didn't really know exactly what to do with it or what way to take it. And I think that's because Leo, you know, hasn't given us other reasons to think that he is at all open to sort of dramatic changes related to church teaching.
Yeah, one of the other little snippets that he gave in the interview that did land a lot of people's radar is he's not here, quote, to solve the world's problems. And I know you can probably read the whole quote, but basically to proclaim the gospel. That struck a nerve, I know, with some people. The pop star, aging pop star Madonna, I think, was unhappy about that. What was your take on that use of the phrase?
Well, I mean, with all respect to Madonna, I mean, I think like this is just basic Christianity 101. John, Jesus Christ says, abide in me and you will bear much fruit, because without me, you can't do anything. And so this idea of like reducing the church to an NGO, just like cutting the church off from its supernatural element, right? The fact that it's the bride of Christ, it's the body of Christ, the Holy Spirit dwells in the church is Christ continued. That's what people want to do. They want to make it like about solving, you know, poverty or solving international conflicts. I think the reality that Pope Leo was saying, because he said that, Matthew, he said, my job isn't to solve the world's problems. But then after that, you know, he said, my job is to proclaim the gospel, to confirm people in their faith. He said part of that, though, is the church, its prophetic voice, right? Like coming into play in the major social and political questions of the day. But it's a question of priority and framing, right? Do you think of the church first as a political actor, or do you think of the church first as the bride of Christ meant to proclaim the gospel? And by being faithful to that, yes, the church will offer life-giving solutions to so many of the challenges and problems we see in the world. So I think it's unfortunate that someone like Madonna heard that and missed the message, because Pope Leo is not saying, I don't care about the world. He's not saying, I don't think there are problems that we need to address. What he's actually saying is the fundamental solution is Jesus Christ. The fundamental solution is for people in the world, for countries in the world, to come to know Christ as Savior, and really the only one who can bring about lasting peace, lasting unity, and lasting happiness. So I think it was just she missed his message. She's a great communicator, but even Madonna, you know, sometimes doesn't quite get what the Pope is saying.
As you say, with all due respect.
of course, yes. As appropriate.
Let me ask you both just real quickly. So we've gotten accustomed to this idea of popes sitting for these extensive interviews. What's the pluses and negatives of doing so, do you think?
Yeah, this is something our colleague Frank Rocha, he's written about, basically how Francis's style of outreach, which involved a lot of interviews, right, and kind of off-the-cuff press conferences, it might be the expectation for popes going forward. Leo, obviously more cautious, but, you know, he chooses to do the sit-down interview, you know, only a few months into his papacy. I think the positives are that personal connection, right? Like, we hear, like, it really does matter that there are credible witnesses for the gospel, right? And that someone can look at not just an idea, but a person who's living the faith and be inspired by them, be motivated by them, connect with Christ through that person. So, you know, the Pope as the visible head of the church on earth, to the extent that these interviews give him an opportunity to do that, that can be quite powerful. I think obviously the danger, the risk of it is, you know, the Pope, I don't think he had the questions ahead of time, and, you know, he's being asked to respond to them live. And, you know, even the best of us, sometimes we aren't as clear or don't say things as precisely in that kind of live setting as we do when we have a chance to sit down and write a whole document about it. So I do think and especially the way the media reacts so quickly and so easily can take things out of context, I think it does potentially, just raise the risk of things being distorted the message being truncated and possibly leading to confusion. Now, the good thing about Leo is his overall style of communication doesn't seem to lend itself to that. But I think that's how I would look at it.
Yeah, and we can add, too, that one change. Now, we highlighted one or two spots where there seemed a certain ambiguity, but he does seem very careful, very prudent in his answers, doesn't he? We have very little time, but just wanted to get a quick take on that.
Yeah. He doesn't, you know, what some pointed out is he doesn't give sound bites. Like Pope Francis is, who am I to judge line? So easy to just take that line, take it out of context, and allow it to mean whatever you want it to mean. Pope Leo's answers aren't really, they're not sound. You kind of have to read the whole thing. You have to read all the context, which then I think
as we would expect, as we would expect from a canon lawyer.
Yes, exactly. It's.
Well, Jonathan, great work as always, and everyone can find Why Leo XIV Avoided a Francis-Style Firestorm in First Sit-Down Interview at ncregister.com. Thanks so much for being with us. So that's it for Register Radio for this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register at ncregister.com. Thanks so much for joining us here. Until next week, on behalf of our producer, Michael McCall, and Shannon Mullen, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Please, take care, and God bless you.